Qatar, which has been the country that is negotiating supposedly a deal between Hamas and Israel, of course, with U.S. involvement. What message do you have to these countries?
That is enough. It's enough. We're not a party to this war. And this is something I told you while I was in Gaza. We're not a party to this war. We're not. We didn't do anything to be suffering that way, that all the Palestinians right now trapped in the territory are still suffering every single day. They cannot, they don't have access to water, they don't have access to food. Their family is suffering relentlessly, they don't have anything. And that this, what is happening, is something that has to stop, because we are humans like anyone across the globe, and we have the right to live. We have the right to have a normal life, because the simplest things here in this country, in Ireland, are not available for people in Gaza. I'm seeing the leftovers people leave in the waste baskets. Those things are precious for Palestinians, for my family, for everyone in Gaza. But you can see the different worlds that we are living in. A whole community, a whole population is being genocided live now, while an entire world of 9 billion people is just to stand by passively, not being able to send one bottle of water or a can of food to children who are starving, who are being brutalized, traumatized, and ostracized as if their lives have no value at all.
And Israel's war crimes go just unpunished. I want to thank you so much for being with us. We have to leave it there. We'll continue our conversation at democracynow.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey there, relatives. We missed you, and I know you missed us. Rose City Native Radio is returning to the airwaves starting May 15th. Nick and I will be back in the saddle again to bring you all the Indigenous news, music, and more. So stay tuned, 90.7 FM, Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Board of Directors meeting will be held on Monday, May 19th at 6 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, just 1 week remains until Oregon's special election on May 20th. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek supports a controversial bill to change foster care in the state. And in international news, Russian President Vladimir Putin is under pressure from President Trump to complete a deal with Ukraine. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 13, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. It's just 1 week until Oregon's special election on May 20th. Voters should have already received their ballot and voter's pamphlet with information about their local races. The special May election happens in odd-numbered years and is mainly for voters to elect board members to different districts like the Water and Fire District and the School Board. In Multnomah County, the ballot also includes three measures. Measure 26258 is the Mount Hood Community College Bond. If passed, the college would issue around $136 million in bonds to help finance repairs and upgrades to their facility. That would include repurposing existing space to create a center for health professions. Measure 26259 is the Portland Public Schools bond. If passed, PPS would extend the bond program that voters passed in 2012, 2017, and in 2020. It helped to modernize 8 schools, with 3 more in design. Extending the bond isn't expected to raise the tax rate over what it is currently, and funds would go towards earthquake readiness and modernizing school buildings. Measure 5305 is the Scappoose Fire District levy. It would renew a local property tax that funds fire and medical services. Multnomah County voters can drop their ballots in a secure drop box by 8 p.m. on Election Day Tuesday, May 20th. They can also mail their ballot up until that date. Multnomah County election staff can help out if voters with disabilities need help with their ballots or if voters need assistance in another language. If voters have not yet received their ballot, officials recommend they call the elections office at 503-988-VOTE. Oregonians now have more power to protect their own personal data online under the Oregon Consumer Privacy Act, and a new free guide is available to help demystify the process. Isabel Charlet has more.
A new tool aims to equip Oregonians with the knowledge they need to take control of their personal data and protect their privacy online. Oregon Consumer Justice created the guide after the Oregon Consumer Privacy Act took effect last summer, empowering residents to control how businesses collect and use their personal data. The guide explains how to request records of collected and sold personal information. Malena Lechon Galdos is with the Portland nonprofit SUMA that helped work on the guide. She says most people do not understand how much of their data, from internet search histories to social security numbers, is being collected, bought, and sold.
The internet is a tool that everyone at this point needs to utilize, even if it's getting basic resources. And so how can we do it in a way that is safe?
The guide includes step-by-step instructions on how to opt out of targeted advertising and stop the sale of personal data. The new tool is free and available in English and Spanish online at ocj.org/data. Cookies, explains Lechon Galdos, help websites track the personal information people enter as well as users' locations. All of this information is bought and sold by data brokers to create personalized advertisements. Information can also be purchased by federal agencies and used in investigations, Lechon Galdos adds, which has raised concerns about warrantless surveillance.
What we want community to know is there are risks here, and here's how to mitigate some of these risks so you can feel more knowledgeable, more in control.
The new tool addresses barriers to digital rights awareness, Lechon Galdos explains, including complex jargon and limited tech access. Oregon Consumer Justice says they hope the information will help build a network of informed data privacy advocates. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek voices support for a controversial bill that would allow the state to send children in foster care to facilities in other states. It also changes the definitions around restraints and seclusions. The measure is known as House Bill 3835. Supporters believe it will help the state's most vulnerable children receive mental health services and quality places to live. But some children's advocates and others involved, including both the House and Senate chairs of the Human Services Committees, oppose the measure. Opponents have said the policy changes will ultimately offer fewer protections and could lead to harming children. Kotek said, quote, "The goal is to improve youth access to behavioral health care. We know that too many children in our state have acute behavioral health care needs. We know that our current system needs repair and is failing too many children. The status quo is unacceptable," end quote. Kotek says protecting children, quote, "transcends politics and is not a partisan issue. State law currently allows officials to send kids out of the state, but the facilities where they are going must first go through a licensing process and meet certain standards. The measure would provide Oregon with the ability to send children out of the state for more care more easily. Some children are being housed in Oregon emergency rooms due to the lack of more appropriate placement. Part of the reason is that it is hard to find staff to work in treatment facilities. Some experts say there are currently so many regulations that staff are worried they will be penalized for child abuse for trying to de-escalate volatile situations. Proponents of the measure say kids would fare better than the last time Oregon sent children in foster care elsewhere. They argue it would allow children to receive specialized care unavailable in Oregon. Still, many of the requirements being proposed appear similar to past practices. U.S. Senator Ron Wyden led a bipartisan investigation into the practice, assessing many of the places where Oregon youth were sent. Tom Stenson, an attorney with Disability Rights Oregon, analyzed the report, saying, quote, "The operating model for these facilities is to warehouse as many kids as possible while keeping the cost low in order to maximize profits. Too often, abuse and neglect is the norm at these facilities, and they're set up to let this happen." He also assessed the policy changes made in the measure. Stenson added, quote, "Whether you trust the advocates and the children who are here speaking for themselves or whether you trust bureaucrats, DHS has left a long trail of broken lives as a result of poor decisions and cover-ups from its administrators. If solemn declarations made children safe, we would have the safest children in the world." End quote. The state recently settled a civil lawsuit brought, in part, by Disability Rights Oregon, demanding that the state lower rates of mistreatment of children placed in foster care. As part of the settlement, an expert has been appointed to oversee the state's child welfare system. Disability Rights Oregon opposes the measure. The Oregon Department of Human Services supports it. A man who harassed a peacock and then shot at the man who told him to stop was sentenced this week. KBOO reporter Onyx has the details.
A man in southeast Portland was sentenced for attempted murder after harassing peacocks. Back in 2023, Dylan Levi Rhodes was harassing peacocks with a friend when he was confronted by a neighboring person. After the victim asked him to stop, Rhodes responded with, quote, "Bawk, bawk, bawk, you're next," and other threats. The victim went back into his home as Rhodes drove off with his friend. When the victim left his home, he was met at an intersection by Rhodes and was shot at. The shots were fired at the driver's seat. The victim was not seriously injured due to the heavy-duty seats in his car. Rhodes pled guilty to attempted murder in the second degree with a firearm and other charges. He is looking at over 7 years for his crimes. For KBOO News, I'm Onyx.
Advocates say Republicans' scaled-back Medicaid cuts still put too much in jeopardy. President Trump defends getting a luxury jet from Qatar, and frustration grows among museum executives who say the White House is trying to erase history. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We've been working on that package for over a year. We knew he was going to win another term and that we would have unified government. We cannot waste this opportunity, so there's not been a lot of rest around here.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says Republicans will have a busy week working on the budget President Donald Trump calls his big, beautiful bill. Key to Trump's domestic agenda are almost $900 billion in Medicaid cuts to pay for extending tax cuts, mostly for the wealthy. The Energy and Commerce Committee will consider adding work requirements and more frequent eligibility checks. Johnson says that'll reduce waste and fraud, but Democrats warn 13 million people could lose health coverage. Chiquita Brooks-Lasser led the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under Biden.
So-called work requirements have only been proven to add rather than reduce wasteful spending to the program, as well as overwhelm eligible enrollees.
The deep Medicaid cuts are unpopular with swing district Republicans who could sink the bill in the nearly tied House. GOP Missouri Senator Josh Hawley says slashing health care for the working class is both morally wrong and political suicide. House leadership may try to get the bill passed by compromising on what's called the SALT deduction. The current text triples the limit on the state and local tax deduction to $30,000 for incomes up to $400,000. It would also exempt some tipped income and overtime pay. U.S. markets surged on news that tariffs on China will be paused for 90 days. Meanwhile, Trump is confirming he'll take a luxurious 747 from the Qatari government. Trump says it'll fill in for the long delay replacement Air Force One.
We have an Air Force One that's 40 years old. And if you take a look at that compared to the new plane of the equivalent, you know, stature at the time, it's not even the same ballgame.
The U.S. has accepted dozens of white South Africans as refugees, even as America's refugee program is essentially frozen. Museum executives say the administration is trying to erase the histories of communities of color. Dr. Noel Trent with the Museum of African American History in Boston says they lost a $500,000 grant, but will defy an executive order to remove exhibits which divide Americans by race.
We will continue to fight for the preservation, conservation, and interpretation of the contributions of people of African descent in New England.
Finally, New York Magazine reports Democratic senators are worried about John Fetterman's fitness. The Pennsylvania Democrat has missed numerous votes, and Arizona's Ruben Gallego says Republicans are trying to get Fetterman to vote for their priorities and even change party by appealing to his pro-Israel stance. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on water safety. New data shows an overwhelming majority of drowning victims are men, and experts advise taking care around cold bodies of water and wearing a life jacket. Then we'll hear from a nurse practitioner about preparing for the upcoming wildfire season, especially for those with serious illnesses. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be a high of 65 degrees, with chances of showers throughout the day expected to drop to a low of 49 degrees in the evening. Tomorrow's weather will be a high of 65 degrees, with chances of showers throughout the day. Today in history, in 1950, influential American Ghanaian singer Stevie Wonder was born. The quote of the day is from medieval English mystic Julian of Norwich, who said, quote, "Our soul may never have to rest in things that are beneath itself." An exhibit on Alaska Native boarding schools was unveiled during a summit at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new exhibit on Native boarding schools has opened in Anchorage at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, it reveals new research into how churches and the federal government teamed up to operate schools in Alaska.
This is a really difficult subject we're talking about.
Thlinkit Elder Bob Sam opened a day-long summit on boarding schools at the Heritage Center earlier this month to help Alaska Natives emotionally prepare for discussions that could awaken old traumas.
The wind can be born a whisper.
Sam shared an ancient story about how the Arctic wind tormented humans until they understood its nature and learned to cope. And like the wind, boarding school trauma was widespread. The president of the Heritage Center, Emily Edenshaw, says its research is part of a larger effort to bring about truth and healing from boarding school trauma by first understanding what took place.
Every single Indigenous person across the country has been impacted either directly or indirectly from boarding schools. It's completely changed our lives forever.
Edenshaw says the Heritage Center has gained unprecedented access to the Reverend Sheldon Jackson's archives at Princeton University, where Jackson studied before he became a famous Presbyterian missionary, and later in 1885, a general education agent for the Territory of Alaska. History often gives him a heroic status, a religious leader who brought education and even reindeer herds to help Alaska Natives. But the research reveals a darker picture, where the boundaries of church and state were crossed, in which military methodologies and religious life coalesced into schools that were run more like prisoner of war camps.
Where did all this stuff come from?
Benjamin Jasek is the Heritage Center's Director of Indigenous Research, also an ordained minister and a descendant of Native boarding school students. He says churches and the federal government had the same mission, to either displace or assimilate Alaska Natives.
It's really important to recognize that this version of Christianity was so interwoven with nationalism that you couldn't pull apart being a, quote, American in terms of the way that they defined American, or a Christian.
The summit also brought together many survivors of boarding schools who told of physical and sexual abuse. The Heritage Center says work goes on to document their stories. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Quantic Broadcast Corporation, which owns National Native News and KMBA, co-hosted the boarding school summit at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. A new grant program in North Dakota aims to help tribes promote tourism. A bill recently signed by the state's governor sets aside $100,000 for North Dakota's five tribal nations for tourism-related projects. Kiara Fox of the MHA Nation Tourism Department says her team can use it to improve signage and other needs while promoting their history in a culturally appropriate way.
We get to tell our stories with our own voices, you know, re-educate a little bit, correct some of those misconceptions everybody has about Native Americans.
She says MHA Nation is off the beaten path, so more visibility with signs might convince drivers to take a detour and check out sites, including a local museum and the Crowfly Scenic Overlook. The bill sailed through the legislature with minor opposition. However, the final sum is lower than the proposed $500,000. Bill sponsors say the initiative benefits regional economies with promotion from tribal and non-tribal areas working hand in hand. As for indigenous communities, Fox says having more tourists spend money locally expands their revenue base. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new Common Sense Institute report on homelessness has come under fire by longtime advocates over claims that Housing First with supportive services has not reduced homelessness. The report also calls for more investment in intervention first programs, which make housing contingent on addiction treatment and workforce training. Eric Galatas has more in Colorado.
A new report on homelessness in Colorado released by the Common Sense Institute has come under fire for muddying the waters for lawmakers and other stakeholders working to get people off the streets and back on their feet. The report claims that an intervention-first model, where people only get housing if they agree to addiction treatment and workforce training, is more effective than the Housing First with Supportive Services approach, which it says has failed to decrease homelessness. But Kathy Alderman with the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless says the report doesn't even mention rising housing costs.
When we see housing costs go up, when we see rents increase, we see homelessness increase. When we don't see more affordable housing being made available to low-income households, we see homelessness increase.
Between 2019 and 2023, Denver's already high rents rose by nearly 30%. Last year, there was a gap of more than 134,000 affordable housing units across the state for workers earning 30% of the median income or less. The Institute has defended its report and said by email that the public deserves to know whether their tax dollars are helping reduce homelessness, not just reshuffling where people sleep. According to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, Housing First reduces homelessness by 88% and improves housing stability by 41% compared with Intervention First programs, which Alderman calls a one-size-fits-all approach.
It says you must participate with those specific services in order to be eligible for housing. There are lots of people experiencing homelessness that don't need substance use treatment, that don't need behavioral health. They need housing.
Housing First programs provide rapid access to housing, and care teams connect people to employment opportunities, medical and mental health care, and substance use treatment. But those services are not required or used as a punitive tool. Alderman says the model works, but current investments just don't meet the scale of the problem.
So if we had the housing resources and we were providing more housing with supportive services to larger populations of people experiencing homelessness, we would absolutely see a reduction in homelessness, but we've never had the political will to do that.
This is Eric Galatas for the Colorado News Connection.
Vladimir Putin is under pressure from President Trump to complete a deal with Ukraine. Putin has to weigh several competing concerns, including Trump's timetable and Russia's economic problems. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says Putin will soon have to choose between settling for less territory and confronting Trump's growing impatience. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. As Donald Trump's pressure mounts on both Russia and Ukraine to reach a deal, Vladimir Putin is in a particularly difficult position. Whereas Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has reached a minerals deal with Trump and agreed to a 30-day ceasefire, Putin has avoided any concessions. Instead, he continues to prosecute the war, causing numerous civilian deaths as Russia bombs Kyiv and other cities. Trump has expressed some exasperation with Putin, but has yet to make any new demands of him. Let's try to read Putin's mind as he considers his options. First, his forces have made important territorial gains in the war, but have fallen well short of the total victory Putin anticipated when Russia invaded in February 2022. Putin has by no means discarded his view that Ukraine is not a legitimate state and should one day belong to Russia. But Russian forces have so far only occupied about 20% of Ukraine's territory. So Putin has to ask himself, how do I justify my losses if we stop now? That question is at the heart of U.S. and European intelligence analysis. Will Putin settle for less? CNN reports on one analyst's thinking, representative of what many others believe, that Putin's next move, quote, depends on what is the U.S. willing to put on the table so that he could not just claim victory domestically, but really feel that he has achieved something that is worth a significant pause, and then maybe retake up the fight at some point later. This official pointed to Putin's repeated references to where the Russian people have historically come from, and said he maintains a long-term objective to seize more of Ukraine, at least those portions that are the cradle of Russian civilization, in Putin's eyes. Moscow was willing to play along with the U.S. and restrict its immediate objectives to improve its relationship with Washington, a senior European official agreed, but, quote, clearly hasn't given up on their maximalist war ends. Playing along is not the whole of Putin's likely thinking, however. His second consideration, the Trump factor. Putin has to weigh the different timetables he and Trump seem to be operating on. Trump wants a deal that he can use for domestic, political, and personal gain. Putin has to ask himself, how long can I count on having Trump on my side? Putin sees that Trump is shifting his allegiance somewhat by getting a minerals deal he says will provide a way for the U.S. to help Ukraine's security. At the same time, Trump is threatening sanctions on Russia if Moscow doesn't start talking in earnest. The uncertainty factor here is important. What might Trump's tipping point be? Putin's latest proposal for direct talks with Ukraine is a way of testing Trump's patience. The third factor is Russia's slowing economy. Not so slow that he can't continue the war, but slowing enough that he needs to weigh fighting on or taking what he has gotten. While inflation has held steady, manufacturing, imports, consumer spending, and the poverty rate all show worrisome statistics. Overall, Russia's economic growth is expected to go from around 4% to around 2.5% this year. The fourth factor, pressure from Putin's arms industry to keep producing munitions and expanding the army. Can he afford to alienate it? According to the Center for European Policy Analysis, 60% of Russia's manufacturing is weapons production. Moreover, that report says, quote, while the economy is in orderly decline, the war effort will remain fully financed. The Kremlin views the military-industrial complex as the primary driver of the economy, and its financing is a top priority. Other sources indicate that Putin is engaged in a major rearmament program, which led France's President Emmanuel Macron to say, how believable is it then that today's Russia will stop at Ukraine? In short, Putin must have the Russian military-industrial complex on his side, especially if, as reports from the Baltic states claim, he intends to pressure his near neighbors in the future. Thus, Putin's three options. First, take what's on the table and postpone an effort to grab the rest. That would mean dropping Moscow's current demands for international recognition of all of the Ukrainian territory its forces now occupy, for limiting the size of Ukraine's army, and for prohibiting Ukraine membership in NATO forever. Option two, keep up the military pressure on Ukraine and hold out for more territory. Most Western analysts don't see that as a possibility, but Putin may believe he needs to show more victories to justify 3 years of warfare. The third option, accept a ceasefire but don't honor it, thus pacifying Trump with a short-term victory while preparing to pry more territory away from Ukraine. If those are Putin's options, it's easy to understand why Ukraine wants a security backstop before agreeing to a settlement with Moscow. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 13, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Lexis Ponce, Kenny B., and Onyx. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, Eric Galatas, Alex Gonzalez, and Kathleen Shannon. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Lexis Bonso. As wildfires grow more frequent and intense across the West, families are preparing, stocking up on air purifiers, backup chargers, and emergency supplies. But for those living with terminal or serious illnesses, wildfires present a unique and dangerous threat. I spoke with Martha Beach about how families with serious medical needs can build smarter wildfire kits and how people can prepare for fast-moving evacuations when every second matters.
I am an acute care nurse practitioner. I work for the federal government with the VA, and my husband has a diagnosis of what a lot of people know as Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, and some might know it as motor neuron disease, essentially rendering a person paralyzed. Eventually it's progressive and requires toward the end of life a lot of medical equipment and a lot of medical attention.
What is your experience with emergency situations like wildfires?
With emergency situations, my husband and I were not only the victim of one hurricane, Hurricane Helene in September of 2024, where we lost our home, all of our vehicles and our belongings, but we then were the victims again of a second hurricane, two of the most damaging hurricanes to ever hit the state of Florida within 10 days of one another. So we were hit first with Hurricane Helene, and what was left of any